Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. So glad you could join us today. A couple of months ago, NPR News aired an interview which highlighted the importance of having just one Black teacher. It can make a big difference in the lives of students, especially Black boys. For that interview, American Public Media special correspondent Lee Hawkins sat down with his former teacher when he was in elementary school in Maplewood, Harold Bridgman. That meeting inspired Hawkins to keep the discussion going. So recently, he met with four Black male educators to talk about the impact of Black representation in classrooms and in school offices. Lee spoke with Michael Walker, the director of Black Student Achievement for Minneapolis Public Schools, Michael Thomas, superintendent of Prior Lake Savage Area Schools, retired teacher Eric Robinson, and Derek Francis, who this month was named Executive Director of Equity and School Climate for Minneapolis Public Schools. He previously managed the district's counseling services. Here's Lee Hawkins.
Thank you all for being here. I'm really excited about the opportunity to bring you brothers together in this discussion. So thank you. Only 2% of the nation's teachers are Black males. That's a tough number to swallow, but here's something that's mind-blowing for you all to digest. Across the state of Minnesota, there are only 1.45% Black teachers, male or female. So that's even less than the percentage of Black male teachers across the nation. Only 1.45% Black teachers in a state where Black people make up 7% of the population. What does this mean for Black children from Minnesota, particularly boys, and what will their educational experience be like as a result? Let's start with you, Michael Walker.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So what will their experience be like? Well, we already know that representation matters. We got to make sure that we have people that look like them in front of the classrooms, right? And when we think about how does that impact the growth and development of young people is that when we see folks that look like us, it gives us the ability to see that we have that possibility to be an educator as well. The school system is not designed for them to have to feel valued, to feel welcomed. Like, the cultural aspects of our schools are a little different than what our Black students are experiencing, right? So it's not designed for them. And so we have to really think about how do we address that piece. The other components of why the experience is different is that, what is about our curriculum? Like, how is the curriculum set up? We have a Eurocentric curriculum, again, that is not centering the experiences of our Black people. And so how do we change that is some of the things that we have to address.
Okay, great. Michael Thomas, what does this mean for the kids who are in these classrooms without people who look like them?
Yeah, I take it right back to, you know, the psychology of one's health and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When a young person doesn't have a sense of belonging, they're going to struggle no matter what that, you know, gap might be. And in this case, a lot of our young Black students, specifically young Black boys, to your question, they don't see themselves in the curriculum. They don't see themselves in terms of adult authority in the school systems. And so it becomes very psychologically isolating, and with no outlet or sense of support, that's where you begin to see, you know, a young, immature mind trying to make decisions for themselves that are well beyond their comprehension. And so that's where we might see some kids falling off, because they don't have the ability to, you know, make some of the best decisions without, you know, the struggles that they're going through and not being able to have somebody that they can trust to go to help kind of process and support them through some of the challenges. So I think, you know, I would just center there first. And you can fast forward 30 years as adults. You know, many of us sitting in this room were oftentimes maybe the only one, you know, only teacher, only administrator in a system where we also had that level of isolation and had, you know, to navigate very carefully, you know, our own existence to kind of stay alive in that system. So I think that's where I would center first. How do we address that social, psychological need of our kids?
Great. And Derek, you're counseling kids. When kids come into your office and you're doing the counseling, do you ever get the feeling, wow, this person could really use some diversity in terms of the people who are educating them?
Oh, man, that is, I think, the thing that comes to mind, especially when you're thinking about career development, and especially for our youth, the exposure to seeing someone who looks like you. So many times when students, they have just what they see on TV. So I show up as a black person in the school, and I start to teach lessons around, well, guess what? Let me show you pictures of people who look like you, and they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're educators, and it opens the mind. And I think that's so neat because it's really exposing them to their hope and future. And I start to share with students, you have so many different career opportunities, and here's some schools where you see students that look like you. And that makes a difference if you have a counselor that hasn't been around or seen black people or black students do some of these successful things, you might limit them from your own view. So it's so important for someone to say, oh, I see you. I've seen people who look like you do some of these things, and that's going to be you.
It's so interesting that you say that, because people of all races have stories of being counseled out of going into certain careers by their counselor because their counselor didn't believe in them. I particularly remember a story of a woman who is very, very prominent in the science field, a black woman that I went to school with, who talking about being counseled away from STEM, which is right now she's one of the top people at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Mm-hmm. And so many people have these how you like me now stories. And it's sad because you shouldn't have to have those stories. Mm-hmm. You should be able to say, I had the support from my village from the beginning. Before we get too deep into this, it's really important that we frame the problem that we're addressing right now. Boys collectively, of course, of all races, are not performing academically and socially as strong as girls. We know that. And in the case of black boys, they're not an exception. And as the effort to close the racial opportunity gap continues, it's important to look at how our educational system can do a better job with black boys. And if we're going to discuss the issue, we need to be transparent and candid from what you see right now, from what you see statistically and in the classroom. Are black boys underperforming? Eric, you want to take that?
Right now, you know, students are looking at this as a Eurocentric, you know, type of system. And, you know, maybe when they're younger, elementary age, you know, there's a little bit of hope. But then as they get more toward high school or middle school, then that starts to dwindle as far as improving their reading or math goals, you know. So that follows them. I mean, working with high school students in a charter school and knowing that they can't get anything any higher than a fourth grade reading level, you know, it comes back to having that presence of a black teacher in the classroom to, you know, to say that you can do this, you have value, you're worthy of you know, careers that you think you don't think you're capable of doing.
I wanted to shift this over to you, Michael, because you work in black, you're the director of Black Student Achievement for Minneapolis Public Schools. Are black boys underperforming?
So I know you start off by saying it's an opportunity gap. And what I tend to believe in and kind of the research that I've done, it's really a belief gap, right? It's about what do our adults believe about our black males? Do we believe that they are able to accomplish success? Do we believe that they're able to achieve whatever goal there is that they're trying to achieve? If we don't have that belief as adults, then we're going to treat them or have expectations that are lower. right? Because I don't believe that you can be a doctor. I don't believe that you can be a lawyer. I don't believe that you can be a scientist, right? And so it really starts with the adults. And so that's kind of the focus of our work in some of the work that we do. It's really trying to, how do we change the beliefs of the educators so that they can see value in our Black students, specifically our Black males. And so I don't believe in an achievement gap. I don't believe that the young people, our Black males, are underperforming. I believe that the system has been designed and created, and the belief of them in that system has created the outcomes that we see.
Right? Okay. And so in talking about improving outcomes, it's important to introduce some data that I think is just mind-blowing. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University studied about 100,000 Black students who entered third grade at North Carolina public schools between 2001 and 2005. About 13% of the students ended up dropping out of high school, while about half graduated, but with no plans to pursue college. Okay. Mm-hmm. However, low-income Black students who were assigned to at least one Black teacher in third, fourth, or fifth grade were not only less likely to drop out of school, but 18% more likely to express interest in college when they graduated. And persistently low-income Black boys who had at least one Black teacher in third, fourth, or fifth grade were 29% mm-hmm. more likely to say that they were considering college. And I spoke to Nicholas Papageorge, who was the lead researcher on this study at Johns Hopkins, and he told me that the big difference is that Black teachers tend to have higher expectations for Black students. Michael, when we were in the green room, you were talking about when you were working in Osseo. Mm-hmm. I'm Dr. Thomas. I believe in you, and mm-hmm. you're going to come in here, and you're going to perform up to your potential. Tell mm-hmm. me what about that experience.
You know, I'll say it stems back to when I was in sixth grade. I actually had a sixth grade teacher who called me the N-word and said I wasn't going to amount to anything. And now, don't get me wrong, I'm sure I was a handful and maybe wasn't always making the best choices, but to have an adult teacher who had power and influence over me kind of cut me down at that level, you know, I'm 50 years old. I have never forgotten what that felt like, right? And so fast forward to myself being an educator, I knew very well I was never going to let a young Black kid, basically a mini-me, experience what I experienced. And so I had a lot of positive Black men in my life who countered that. And that was part of my job when I was a principal. Yes, I'm here to serve all kids. And that was a non-negotiable. I also knew I had to bring a point of emphasis for my kids of color. And that was very clear based upon my data. And if you were Black and you lived in a certain zip code and you were coming to my school, I could predict outcomes, unfortunately. And so for me, it was to have a tough conversation. I remember I got criticized for pulling a lot of the Black students together and essentially letting them know you're not on track to graduate. Mm. And if you continue on this path, you're not going to find success in life. And there was a lot of backlash to why would you break confidentiality and, you know, having families know each other's business. I'm like, this is a small community. If we don't talk about this and put truth out there, I need the families to come and join me in helping these young men and young girls find a better path in life. And so we were successful in my junior high, closing that achievement gap by almost, you know, 45% in a period of 3 years, because the intentionality was data-driven. I could see it. No one can deny it. The numbers are here. But going back to what Dr. Walker was just saying, it was about a mindset shift. Kids don't come to our schools. They're not dumb, right? These kids are looking to become successful, whatever that means for them. And it's our jobs as adults to be that bridge to that. But if I don't believe, in as an adult, if I don't believe that this young kid can ever achieve something, you know, subconsciously, it's going to come out in my practice. Yeah. I'm not going to call on Eric. You know, I'll call on everybody else in the classroom, but I'm not going to call on Eric. You know, I'm going to be, you know, writing discipline referrals for, you know, young Mr. Francis, if he was my kid. Like, that comes out because you can't necessarily change beliefs, although there's a belief gap. I totally believe that. But I can manage the behaviors that are manifestations of what you believe. And that's what my job was as a principal, as an administrator, to look at the adult behaviors that were derived from their belief sets of what kids are going to do well and who's not going to do well. And then those were the tough conversations that allowed us to really kind of peel that onion back and get to the core of what we needed to get to.
And I'll tell you, it must be hard years later when you're seeing that black kid that was in your class and he's on TV now, or he's he's the superintendent of schools, or you're reading about kids you taught in the in the school system and you didn't believe in them. Mm-hmm. It's an educational journey for a lot of educators in this country. Mm-hmm. There's one critical thing growing up in Minnesota taught me, and that's that it's not always about malice or racial animus. A lot of times it's about people not having experience with black people. You haven't been around black people in your life. And that means you're bringing a lot of this bias and prejudice into the classroom to the point that you're still, you're nervous around the kid.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Am I right about it?
Yeah. Yes.
Am I right about it in terms of your colleagues when you're in the break room?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Is that real? Tell me.
Oh, I mean, and the thing is, too, I think the way it comes out, even the way you hear it in the language is how I hear it. Just the students who, and it's always in opposition. So the students who are doing well, oh, they're, that's a, such a good kid. They're great family. Their siblings were smart. Or if it's a student who is from, as a black student, is, you know, they're in the hall again. Or even the way it's around not giving the same amount of grace when an assignment's missing or a student might be a minute late walking in the room. It's a different tone. And the students I know see it too. They'll know what black students the staff is more short with, mm-hmm. Or doesn't call on as much. And I think also, too, as a black staff at a school, I've had times where I can tell staff will kind of dance around saying certain things to me because they know I'll pick up on what they're really trying to say about that student or their family. And so I do think it's a lack of exposure. It's a lack of being, you can just tell, like, maybe their friendship group might not be as diverse. And I think as educators, being aware of that, because if you're going to work with black students and say that you're working in that neighborhood or working in an inner city, you have to be cautious and aware of the experiences and have that humility to say, hey, I don't know what that's like. Let me listen and glean some knowledge from my black colleagues that are here. I think that's so important to have that kind of humility.
Hmm. Eric.
Yeah. And I think that that bias, what you said earlier, has a lot to do with it, because the white teachers, they would have in mind, well, this is how they would behave. You know, I remember when I started early in education, there was this one teacher, and I was working with the black students, the black boys, and it was always every day the same two or three would, it's like a revolving door, you know, instead of this person, this male person, giving grace or, you know, understanding, well, why are these students doing this? Or, you know, trying to work with that student. But, you know, the teachers would have this in mind that they all behave the same way. And, you know, what I've noticed, just to switch gears here, what I've noticed as far as administrators, right, principals, you know, like the assistant principal was working always with behavior, you know, and that was the role, a black male working in behavior. Well, they can take care of these students, you know, because they know how to handle them. But it goes beyond that, yeah. You know, literally it goes beyond that, because if there were black male teachers in the classroom, then those things wouldn't occur. Mm. There wouldn't be suspensions and, you know, with over suspending students of color, males. And I know I shared this with you the other day about this individual that actually, he graduated this June, and he was in my ethnic studies class a couple of quarters ago, and he never passed. Never. In fact, he would disrespect me by calling me Eric, by my first name. And toward the middle of this summer, he came in. He owed certain assignments and everything. The teachers were working with him, and they had compassion on him, and they knew he had to get graduated. And he graduated. He got everything done. And when he would see me, he would call me Mr. Eric, you know, because he was succeeding. You know, years ago, he was a certain behaviors would come out and everything, and teachers would overlook that. They gave him time. They gave him a rope. You know, just hey, you can do this, and he did it. You know, but in some schools, right, some classrooms, they're not given that chance. If a student is gifted, maybe their behavior is elter-skelter. Mm-hmm. However, there's something beneath that. And, you know, teachers don't always see that. They look at the behavior first instead of getting to know that student.
Whereas if you're Elon Musk or something and you're acting out in class, they'll just say, well, he's not challenged. We need to challenge him. Let's not focus so much on the behavior. You mentioned people expecting the same behavior from all of the black students. And it reminded me of my cousin who went to my high school, North St. Paul Senior High School, who actually was called to the office about a matter that pertained to another black student, where they actually thought he was the black student that they were talking to. And, you know, I've experienced this in corporate America, where I've been called the name of another black reporter. Whereas, you know, and so that's how deep the issue is. This whole idea of people not knowing how to deal with black people, sometimes not even knowing the difference between black people.
Well, and also, you know, to your question earlier, and Eric, you as well, just brought up, you know, like they bring one of the four of us in to handle these black kids, right? And again, we're all passionate black men who care deeply about our communities and care deeply about, you know, black kids, no doubt. But We're more than that, right? And we, even as professional men with degrees, we get relegated and tracked, right? Just like Hollywood, right? You can act this part. And you know, I'll never forget my very first year as a principal. That was the narrative, you know? And one of the staff came up to me and said, hey, just want to let you know, staff are all really happy that you're coming here and finally being able to handle a lot of the behavior issues of, you know, these students of color. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, and my very first staff meeting, you know, August workshop week comes up. And, you know, one of the statements I said to my staff, you know, which was all white minus one person, was just because you're white doesn't mean you're not right. And don't think that's going to exonerate you from accountability for all kids in the school. Right. And it gets to that fear piece, Lee, that you were speaking to. Like, they don't want to say something because either they're afraid of being called racist or, you know, whatever it might be, or they just don't know. But at the end of the day, your expectations that you have for some kids need to apply to all kids. And you can't lead from a place of fear. And you can't expect me as a black person to own your issue. Right. So that was my push to really getting my staff to embrace.
Yeah.
This is about you, not so much about the student.
Dr. Michael Thomas, we had a conversation and I asked you to send me a copy of your dissertation. The reason I asked for it is because it studies African-American male school leaders in predominantly white school systems and how they negotiate their racial identity without committing cultural sacrifice. And I want to read this sentence that you wrote. You said, and I quote, "It is said that being a school administrator is a very lonely and challenging position to have. One must continually negotiate who they authentically are in an effort to remain in the position," you wrote. Mm. It was 1996 when you wrote this. Mm. Now that you're a superintendent, and you're actually living this, do you think that you were way ahead of things? I mean, because it seems like that's what we're talking about now, is that as educators trying to influence the black male achievement equation, you're going through your own sort of identity mm-hmm. issues with people projecting things on you.
Mm. Yeah, that's a deep question, Lee. And there. You know, when I was the only in a system, it was a real lonely place. On top of that, when you're in, you know, higher levels of leadership, there isn't a lot of people you can go to and talk to because you might feel as though you can't do the job, and you don't ask those kind of questions, right? And I've had colleagues say, "Oh, here goes Michael. He's on that black stuff again," right? I mean, colleagues. and I'm sitting there thinking, if you're saying this to me as an adult, what are you doing with kids when you close your classroom door, mm-hmm. right? And at the same time, because my deep commitment to ensuring that young black students didn't experience what I went through, and I could still continue to blaze a trail for them to have a much better beaten path to go down, I could only say and do so much before the system then would squeeze me out, mm-hmm. right? And so oftentimes I felt caught because my heart is committed to doing the right thing, and I know me. I know exactly who I am and what I'm about. And thus the name of my title of my dissertation, which is a play off of Sidney Poitier's movie. Guess who's coming to, mm-hmm. to dinner, right? Mm-hmm. How much of my authentic blackness can I be before my plate is pulled from the table, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a real delicate dance. And this is a negotiation beyond education that people of color in this country do every single day.
What I hear you talking about is that identity continues to be an issue. The expectations, what people project on you, certain stereotypes, certain expectations, and that this is something that you must carry with you everywhere as you navigate through the professional world. So if we are experiencing this as grown black men, let's talk about identity and the challenge of identity that black boys are facing every day. And how do they work through that or not?
Yeah.
Let's start with you, Derek.
Oh, man. There's so much. When you talk about identity, I think about it. The first part is how it shows up as the academic system. So when you're looking at the schoolwork, how often are you seeing yourself mirrored in that work, seeing people that look like you that you're learning about? This past month, Juneteenth, how many students didn't even hear about Juneteenth or learn about the history of it? And so just imagine the liberation that comes with being a black person, hearing someone teach you about the true freedom that people who look like you had to fight for and how delayed it was. But also, I think, especially in Minnesota, our schools have this unspoken toxic culture of attacking students who are marginalized. And it shows up in schools through social media. It shows up in things that are said to students about their identity. And so many students talk about how schools don't do anything to speak up when they're attacked as a black student. Well, that bothers you. I'm here to learn. I'm here to get an education. And I'm hearing these things on an ongoing basis, or I'm seeing other people being called these negative things either on social media or in real life. And I have to absorb that day in and day out. And then if I don't have someone at school protecting me to understand what that feels like, that's hard. And so I think that's one of the ways we really need to step up as educators to say, hey, we're going to call out when we hear at sporting events people making monkey sounds to the black athletes. That should not be happening. Or in schools, students posting on social media calling other kids the N-word. Mm-hmm. Because how would I feel safe going to school if I know mm-hmm. that they're seeing that happen and no one's speaking up?
Well, okay. And so there's that problem of the external pressure that black kids are feeling, but there's also internalization of mm-hmm. some of these stereotypes. And I know Dr. Roland Fryer at Yale talked about a while back the acting white phenomenon, where there was actually a social penalty put on kids. The greater, higher their grades, the less socially acceptable they were. And now we're starting to see that sort of shift, which is nice to see that there's that black male achievement or black student achievement is not as stigmatized as it once was. But working as the director of Black Student Achievement in Minneapolis, What do you see along the lines of identity that these kids are dealing with, that our kids are dealing with every day?
Yeah, I think it goes back to kind of what Derek mentioned earlier about the curriculum, right? So when we're looking at the curriculum that we have in our schools, we are sharing identity, right? But we're sharing a Eurocentric identity. So in those classrooms, students, our white students are getting taught about how they have discovered this, how they have created and invented this, all these great things that they have done, right? Which, okay, fine. Where is that for the other groups in our school system, right? How are we not uplifting those narratives and those stories? And so in our program in Minneapolis Public Schools, we have a class called Black. It stands for Building Lives, Acquiring Cultural Knowledge, where it is designed to teach some Afrocentric curriculum and to show them the benefits that they have created and what they have done for this society and this country. But it also goes back to before we came to this country where things were better and things were invented on the continent of Africa, so they can understand the foundation of that. So it's not just what happened here in the States, right? And that is important, right? Because when we think about schooling, and I'll just experience for myself, is I learned about being enslaved. Mm-hmm. That was the foundation of what they told me about myself, right? Mm-hmm. So if that's the foundation that you are sharing with these young people, well, we are intentionally creating a thought and an idea in these kids' minds of who they can be and where they came from. Mm-hmm. So we have to undo that and show that there is a much better place. Yeah, enslavement was a portion of our history, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's not all of our history, right? Right. Mm-hmm. And then we also have to, like,
hang on. And if you're going to teach enslavement, then teach enslaver.
Enslaving. For sure.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And what the role of Thomas Jefferson was, mm-hmm. right, with his biracial children, mm-hmm. some who are buried right here in Madison, Wisconsin. Let's go to that cemetery. Mm-hmm. Let's bring the classroom to the cemetery to see the kids that Thomas Jefferson had with Sally Hemings. Mm-hmm. It's important to teach all of that, for but sure. The complexity and the nuance of it all. Eric, you taught ethnic studies.
Yeah, and I mean, right? I could piggyback on you, Doctor. You know, the same thing, you know, identity. You know, when students first come into that classroom, I say, well, what is your story? Mm-hmm. Know your story, however it may be in your family. But it still goes back to slavery. You know, none of us of color or indigenous natives have not had a certain history, you know, through the colonists. So I know Du Bois talks about a double consciousness.
Double consciousness.
Yes. Right? And we experience that as adults, as a black man. But the students, they need to know who they are and where they've come from and where they're heading.
Is it hard? I mean, you taught ethnic studies at a time in which there is a national backlash against teaching of ethnic studies.
Right.
People calling it critical race theory, exactly. Which it isn't. It's American history. So tell me about ethnic studies and teaching it and the effect that has on not only students of color, but students in general of all
right.
races.
And I think the point where I come from when I'm teaching that class or when I co-taught that class is not just African Americans, but indigenous natives, mm-hmm. Asian Americans, mm-hmm. you know, our whole global society has been affected by colonialists, and not just England, but Portuguese and Spain, Spaniards, you know. So this is an area that our kids, our black kids, our students, they come from communities where, you know, they're not exposed to it in education. I've learned some of this while I was teaching, mm-hmm. you know, research, because I hadn't had this mm-hmm. in elementary, middle, even in undergraduate, mm-hmm. master's. I had none of this, and I had to learn it on my own so I can teach it. So if this can happen to me, can you imagine what our right. students are dealing with?
Right.
You know, they're not exposed to it.
I want to shift the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about the school-to-prison pipeline. Growing up, there were two places in Minnesota that you had to avoid if you were a young black boy. It was Totem Town and Red Wing. Those were juvenile detention centers that people went to. And many came back and they were never the same. In fact, I can remember the precise days that some people were literally placed by a teacher on the school to prison pipeline. It was, you got in a fight. You had marijuana. You had a knife. You'll never amount to anything. Get out of my class right now. You're out of here. And that's just enough to ruin a kid's life. And you're sending them into a community, unfortunately, where they do feel accepted. And that begins the school to prison pipeline. I know people who are still in prison right now that I went to school with. Is that something that you see, and how do you make the schools more sensitive to the trauma that leads kids to make the mistakes that lead them into juvenile detention?
Yeah. And you talked about the ones that are like front and center that we see all the time, right? The mm-hmm. fights or whatever. Those are the ones that we see. But there's other school to prison pipeline that may be invisible to the outside
like
world.
Like what?
Like directing our kids into special education programs and label them as EBD.
Okay.
Right? Like that's another track to school to prison pipeline, because now you get on this transition and now you're in a level four setting and now you're in an enclosed school with yeah. all these different setting that yeah. trajectory up right there. So that's another like maybe less direct way that we may not see on the outside. But yes, so does those things happen? Yes, of course they happen. What we have to start to do is really, again, center what are we talking about. Are we really looking at behavior from a Eurocentric lens, right? We talked about students not being able to feel the full range of emotions, our Black students with this social and emotional learning. Well, if I get angry, my anger may show up differently. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I am a threat. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I should be sent down to the SRO office or whatever. I'm just upset right now. And give me time to go through my emotions and go through that. But I don't get an opportunity to do that. And so now I am put into this category that I am violent, that I am a threat, and now anything that I do mm-hmm. gets heightened. Right. And so what we're talking about here is confirmation bias, right? So now we have educators who are looking to confirm their bias that they already have about these Black students mm-hmm. by when they make one act.
And push it. And they'll push the button until the until the trigger pops. Mm-hmm. And now that student, you know, is like Dr. Walker just said. And in the thing is, it's those, I guess, both macro and micro, you know, acts that are committed on, particularly on young kids of color. And a lot of the prevention work that Michael has done with the Black program, I remember years ago when I was doing Project Kofi in St. Paul Public Schools, same thing. It was doing a lot of co-teaching mm-hmm. with my colleagues, giving them an additional lens to look through that they didn't get trained in their teacher prep programs, right? Mm-hmm. And or they weren't comfortable, they weren't, you know, fill in the blank, as we just talked about earlier. But we've all seen our colleagues, particularly our white colleagues, who may have that light turn on for themselves. Like, oh, I see that now. And so I don't want to, you know, be in this doomsday conversation, right, that you know, nothing's going well. There's a lot of improvement, no doubt. But there are, I'll speak for myself, maybe, you know, I know these brothers can probably validate too, but we've all seen opportunities where teachers get it and they lean mm-hmm. into that space and they take that and now they are part of that conversation, right, of helping this young kid. But that goes back to us just not being the ones relegated to that space, right. You know. It's way bigger than the four of us. We can do a lot, but you know, we don't have S's on our chest or wear red capes to work.
Okay, we're going to wrap up in a minute, but I just have two more questions. Why aren't there more Black men teaching in the classroom, and what can be done to recruit and retain more? You want to start, Eric?
Yeah, this thing about recruitment. I went through a program through St. Thomas, and I already had my BA in another area, but I was recruited by an individual who saw something in me and said, "Well, yeah, you know, you'd be a great teacher, right?" Two men, you know, first Dr. Terrell, you know, who was back then, and this man that was a recruiter. I think our universities, right, we have quite a few within the Twin Cities, need to send out those recruiters to our schools. Because, like we mentioned earlier, like there are gifted students in the classrooms, black boys, you know, and girls in the classrooms already. So those that might be in high schools, juniors, seniors, and recruiters from these universities or these, you know, these schools, these colleges need to go into these high schools and have some type of program with incentive to get these young men or women out, you know, and say, well, hey, this is, you know, this is for the community. Mm. You can do this. But, you know, it can't be, it might be me, but it has to be somebody from these colleges that know what's going on in these schools and, you know, collaborate with these schools and have them go in and recruit. Or communities, whatever community access is, organizations, nonprofits that are out there as well. I mean, you have, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but that's what needs to be done. You know,
yeah, the Q program. So
I went through Q.
You went through. Yes, I'm saying you were a Q. All right.
Yeah. Okay, good. Derek. Yeah. What do you think?
As I'm hearing this, because I'm from Minnesota, Minneapolis, Twin Cities area, born and raised. I went to Champlain Park High School, Anoka, Hennepin area, and I had one black teacher my entire K through 12 career. And then when I was in high school, I had a white teacher who saw me working with elementary kids through the child and care occupation course. And she started saying, whoa, you're talented. You're good. And I share this because it was something that I carried with me. When I went to get my licensure to be a school counselor, I originally wanted to be a news anchor. I went to be, and I started volunteering after I didn't get a gig in news, being a news anchor. And then my teacher, I saw her again. She was like, you know what? You ever think about going to counseling? And then when I got to University of Minnesota, I met a professor there that would speak into me. He was like, you're talented. And mind you, I was the only black man in my course in high school and in my program for school counseling. And so the importance of that belief, that encouragement. And so that's something I carried with me is, and I say this also too, white listeners out there, don't think you can't do the work. Mm-hmm. Don't think for a second that it's only, because there's, you know, there's not enough black people in education for us to wait for just us to do it. So white educators, we need you. We're in this all together. And so speak into, have that belief in your heart about black boys. See the potential and the skills when you see it, speak into that, because who knows where that seed will land. And so I think it's so important. That's what we really need to do. And I do that. That's why I went to be a school counselor, because I know the power of not just having that belief, but then speaking that word over people.
Okay, Dr. Walker, I know one thing that you said that was powerful of the many things you've said was that if we're not creating an environment where black men or black boys feel comfortable in the educational setting, what makes them want to come back?
Yeah, I say it all the time. Yeah, the recruitment is... We're probably the only profession that have students for 13 years to recruit. So if our black boys are getting a horrible experience going through the school system, why would they choose to come back and work in it? So the first thing we have to do is give them a better experience, meaning do we value them while they're in the school system? Do we see that they're great and they're geniuses is what Derek is speaking about? If we can do that, then we may have more of them interested in this profession. The second thing is what Derek said is who is being directly speaking that into students, say, hey, you know what, Michael Thomas, as a second grader, you will be a really good teacher one day. You ever thought about that profession?
Is that what happened, Mike?
You know, it didn't happen with me, but I'll tell you, it happened with my daughter.
Okay.
So my daughter, who's going to be a senior at Hampton University next year, is an elementary education major. And it was that intentionality from my mother-in-law. She was a first grade teacher. And long ago when my daughter was a little girl, said, you'd be a great teacher, you know, and she's never forgotten that. And so she will be graduating and Anybody looking to hire a dynamic teacher?
What's so funny in the green room? You said, are you sure you want to do this?
I did. You know, I've had to have that conversation. I mean, given what's going on in education these days, I mean, it can be a scary space, you know. Yeah, but my daughter, she's committed to kids, you know, and she's been working at that youth program in Champlin. You know, she graduated from Champlin Park High School as well. Derek was her counselor, I credit, you know, people like Mr. Francis who really help, you know, stay in touch with her to keep her, you know, inspired to being great. So,
okay, final question here. And that's because I want to make sure that we end this on a positive note. It's been a really hard conversation, a really illuminating, enlightening one, but definitely a hard conversation. Of you four, how many of you had a black teacher growing up? Michael, did you?
I did. I had some when I was in Indiana, and then when I came to Minnesota.
K-12.
Yep, K-12.
Okay.
When I was in Indiana, but they were women.
Okay.
I only had one black male teacher.
What was his name?
His name was Mr. Jackson, taught biology at Roosevelt High School in South Minneapolis.
Okay. Shout out to Mr. Jackson. Dr. Michael Thomas.
No black teachers in high school. My first was Dr. Eric Harmon when I was in college. I believe he was at Century College back in the day.
Shout out to Dr. Eric Harmon. We're thinking of you today. Thank you. Brother Eric Robinson,
I didn't have any black teachers, male teachers, but I knew of them. Elementary school there when I was in fifth grade. You know, Mr. Dunn and Mr. Webster. I'll never forget them. They were firm. And they meant business. So,
and you said they came in with suit and tie every day.
Suit and tie. They were always clean. So, and they were the only black male teachers in the schools.
Okay. And finally, Derek, how about you? You mentioned one. Let's get the name out.
He knows who he is. Mr. Clark Sanders. I had him as a teacher. And I ended up working with him when I was a school counselor, so we ended up being colleagues. And so, Mr. Sanders, I know I'm going to send this to you to listen. I appreciate you, man. Thank you so much.
And, of course, mine is Dr. Harold Bridgman, who I did a piece, me and Mr. Bridgman, it was called for Minnesota Public Radio. And he was a substitute teacher at Weaver Elementary School for one day. Yeah. But it was enough for me to remember him and track him down. A couple weeks ago, and he's out there listening. I love you, Mr. Bridgman, and I love all you brothers today.
Love you.
It's powerful, man. I can't tell you how good it feels to see you out here every day making a difference. It is a beautiful thing, and what this does for me is it gives me so much hope for the future. So thank you. Keep doing the work that you're doing. Go out there and continue to be great. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you for the opportunity. Yeah, for sure.
You've been listening to a conversation that American Public Media special correspondent Lee Hawkins recently had with four black male educators. He spoke with Michael Walker, the director of Black Student Achievement for Minneapolis Public Schools, Michael Thomas, superintendent of Prior Lake Savage Area Schools, retired teacher Eric Robinson, and Derek Francis, who is the Executive Director of Equity and School Climate for Minneapolis Public Schools. This hour's conversation was made possible in part by the Minnesota Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Be safe, everyone. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning at 9.